Good morning. May it please the court. I think the starting position is to take a look at the statute itself. And Kim reaffirmed that the right to pursue civil penalties belongs to the state and not an individual employee. When the California legislature created the PAGA, it created a series of conditions precedent that not only the employee had to follow, but the state agency had to follow. Those conditions precedent, when they were met, created a proxy of the state's rights to the employee who was going to be the representative. From that perspective, he becomes deputized and he gets a badge.
Well, opposing counsel argues, well, the state approved the settlement, or at least disapproved the settlement. And so any of those statutory standing issues are waived. What's your response to that?
I'm very sorry, Judge. I did not hear the beginning of your statement.
I said opposing counsel. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Opposing counsel argues that because the state approved, or at least disapproved, the settlement, any of those precedent statutory standing issues are waived. What's your response?
Well, I think it's a false position to say that they approved the settlement. There's a process where you submit the settlement to the LWDA online. But, you know, what happens in real life is different than perhaps the way that counsel would like to characterize it.
So it's deemed approved, isn't it? It's not objected to by the state, so the settlement is deemed approved.
Well, the question becomes, do they have an obligation to object to it? I mean, I think that's really what ends up happening. I think their position, and I've been doing this a long time, and I've seen enough of these cases to know that what ends up happening is they believe that once they turn it over to their proxy, they are going to let the proxy make the determination most of the time. And if you take a look at a couple of the amicus briefs that were filed with judicial notice, that's exactly what they do. They really don't get into the weeds. They leave it up to their proxy. So I think that's a false statement to say that they approved the settlement.
Well, if you're right, how does that impact Mr. Peck's, if you will, standing on the PAGA issue?
Well, I mean, on the PAGA issue, he has standing because he is essentially a quitam type of action, and he has the right to bring the action.
But he wasn't the representative in this particular case. He could bring his own quitam action, I suppose, but he's a stranger to this particular action, right? He's not the representative.
Well, is he a stranger to the action? I mean, this is really Judge Smith has it right when he says it's convoluted, because really the way that this is set up is that there are overlapping interests. So you could have more than one person representing the state on the same set of claims. And so now, what is the obligation? Let's take a look at the obligation of Mr. Peck as this sheriff who's wearing a badge, who's trying to do the best he can for the state. All of a sudden, he sees that there's a settlement that is going to wipe out his claim, and they didn't even have a valid basis to pursue, in this case, it's the 2802 claim.
Is that a different bounty hunter got the bounty first? I mean, the real party in interest is the state, according to the California courts.
Well,
a different bounty hunter represented the state and got the bounty, and your client just is too late to the party.
Well, unfortunately, with that view, then what you're knocking out is the statutory scheme of the California legislature. Because what the California legislature indicates is that there is a pattern under 2699.3 that must be followed. And the conditions precedent, and once again, there are amicus briefs by the Department of Labor Standards that discuss this. And this is our whole claim panel, that really what we have here is an overbroad release. We're not saying that all the claims of Saucillo or Rudzo. And by the way, Saucillo really shouldn't have any right to go forward because he didn't even file an LWDA letter. But recognize the fact that all of these issues are going forward at the same time. And if you take a look at the structure of the settlement itself, it was a class settlement that included a PAGA claim that was certified. So from yet another perspective of standing, my client, Mr. Peck, had the right to object. He had a beneficial interest as a class member. So that's yet another angle. The third angle is that he was invited by the court to pursue the objection.
But, well, I guess what I struggle with, and I think my colleague the same way on this, is that your client has one, if you will, set of rights in connection with the class action. There's quite another set of rights with respect to the PAGA action. And I guess I struggle with the fact of whether Mr. Peck has any standing at all under PAGA, because he's not really personally involved there. How does he have a PAGA claim?
Well, he has a PAGA claim because he sent the LWDA letter.
No, I understand that, but I mean personally, does he have a PAGA claim? Well, anybody can make a PAGA claim, right? You agree with that. You don't need a class action for that.
Clearly, under the California Supreme Court, there are no individual claims. It belongs to the collective.
Exactly. That's my concern. This is, my colleague has said, this is, it's like a key 10, mentioned that as well. But the question is, in this case, does he personally have the standing on the PAGA claim? Does he personally have any right under PAGA that would enable him to do that?
Well, he would have the rights that the state would have.
Got it. You're eating up your rebuttal time. You can do whatever you want, but you wanted to save 5 minutes, and we are now approaching.
I did want to stay some time, but yes, why don't I save my time?
Whatever you like. Okay.
Yes.
So we're now going to hear not from Mr. Marr, but from Mr. Clapp, who has 5 minutes and is aspiring to save 1 minute. Good luck, Mr. Clapp.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to meet you all. Your Honor, I believe the district court, when it's reviewing a class settlement, must look for evidence of collusion, must look for evidence of conflicts of interest. And the degree of the scrutiny varies with the circumstances. And in my view, this case is a case that demands the very, very, strictest of scrutiny. It's something that was made, a settlement that was made not after the counsel and the representative was vetted and we had certification, but before certification. And more than that, it was after the denial of a certification. And the incentives, vary at that point. Not only are plaintiffs counsel looking for fees, but now they have, sunk costs that they are, worried about. In this case, we have like 2,400 hours of time that was essentially evaporated upon the denial of the certification. And that's a tremendous, burden on a plaintiff's counsel, I can tell you from personal experience. And in this case, they essentially abandoned their case after they had the denial of certification. And we have sort of a target-rich environment because we have, 13 other plaintiffs' firms trying to, bring class actions against this particular defendant on these particular issues. So,
yes, because this counsel, and this may not be exactly what you wanted to focus on, but since you're representing Mr. Morris in this, the case of Rose versus SFBSC management seems to be pretty much right on point to what happened here. You have an approval before the settlement has been approved. The standard, the high standard to which you made reference, did not occur. In Rose, the district court was reversed and somewhat chastised by the court What's your position with respect to Rose versus SFBSC management in this case?
I agree, I think it's right on point. It tells us that there has to be a searching inquiry for subtle signs of self-interest. And we have many subtle signs here that, I wouldn't even think they're subtle signs. I mean, one is we don't have a clear sailing agreement. I mean, we do have a clear sailing agreement, and we didn't have any inquiry about what the class got. Why did the defense counsel call up the Rudzel, counsel? Their case had been stayed for 5 years, and they could have called anybody up in the whole universe, 13 other plaintiffs' counsel they could have called. Why did they call the firm that was not doing anything whatsoever to prosecute this case? These are questions I think that a skeptical court would be looking at.
The judge in this case referred to some, I don't want to use the wrong term, settlement master, somebody else that looked at it. What role, if any, should we attribute to that? Is that sufficient, or does that not meet the requirements of Rose?
It's a mediator, and I think Rose told us that it's certainly nice to have somebody else who's involved, but that's not sufficient, I think, is what, Rose basically tells us. But okay. That does not absolve the district court from its obligation to really look very carefully at these things to determine whether or not this particular settlement should have been overturned.
Okay, do you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Very well. We're doing very well so far here. Okay, so now we're going to go to Mr. Gupta, I believe, is next. And you don't have any time to save, so you just go right ahead, please.
Okay, thank you, and may it please the court. Deepak Gupta for the settling plaintiffs. The class action settlement in this case resolved hard-fought litigation in two consolidated cases going back a decade, including numerous depositions and substantial written discovery, including the production of more than 1 million pages of documents. The settlement was negotiated in the shadow of uncertainty and fights over major threshold legal issues. Most significantly, perhaps.
Could I ask how you, just following up on Judge's question to Mr. Clapp, how do you distinguish Rose? Because the district court did say there was a presumption that the agreement is fair. Whereas Rose says, actually, it's quite the opposite. There should be a requirement of having higher scrutiny because right. It's prior to class certification. So how do you distinguish Rose?
Sure. Well, I think what the district court said, if you actually look at, this is pages 4 through 5 of the opinion, the text of the district court's opinion says that the settlement agreement is presumptively the product of a non-collusive arm's-length negotiation.
But and that's not factor, right, is it? Isn't that incorrect?
That's
there is
not
no such
correct.
Presumption in a
that's
case.
Not incorrect, Judge Smith. Let me just try to unpack this, because I think Judge Ikuda is correct. What you cannot draw from the fact that there was an arm's-length negotiation is a presumption that the entire settlement is fair. But remember that revised Rule 23E directs the district court to consider as one factor whether there were arm's length negotiations. And so what I think the fair reading of what the district court did at pages 4 through 5 is to conclude that on that factor, the fact that there were arm's length negotiations cut in favor of approval. But the district court went through each factor and did not allow the arm's length negotiation to infect or to affect the analysis on any of the other factors. And in fact, I think what's most important is what the district court did. And what the district court did here was not act as a rubber stamp, but put the parties to their paces, both at preliminary approval and at final approval. This district court was not satisfied with the original briefing. It asked for supplemental briefing. It held the court to a high standard on the evaluations. It went through the cost and fee records, fly-specked them, and significantly reduced the fees. And so if you're asking, did this court apply a heightened standard of scrutiny, I think the record shows that the district court did. If there's any error here, it's that the district court's law clerk allowed the district court to cite the district court decision in Rose without adding, reversed on appeal. And really, they should have cited the the Ninth Circuit's decision. Although,
not only that, I can say it relied upon that, used almost the exact language of Rose that we reversed. What other than Rose did the district court cite rely on the point that you're making?
Oh, I mean, the district court, you know, that citation to Rose is precedes the sentence that I read you that says that this was the product of a non-collusive arm's length negotiation, which is correct. And then the district court's conclusion in that paragraph was this factor favors approval. All the other discussion of the standard has nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. And if you look at what the district court did, as I said, it engaged in heightened scrutiny. And I just think it's important to look at what was animating this court's decision.
While I'm thinking about this, I want to get your take on it. Yeah. My reading was that the district court followed Rose almost in hoc verba. Did I miss something?
The Ninth Circuit, this court's decision in Rose, I think is totally consistent with what the district court did here.
Didn't the district court in this case follow the language of the district court in Rose before we reversed it?
No, I don't think so, Judge Smith. I think the only reference to Rose is nested in this paragraph at page 4 of the district court's decision. And it's just, it's along the way to the district court making a totally unremarkable conclusion, which is that the fact that there was arm's length negotiation favors approval on that one factor. There's nothing wrong with that. That's totally consistent with Nice.
You think the Rose site was just like part of a string site that no particular, the court didn't rely on?
I think the problem, frankly, I mean, just candidly, the problem is the parenthetical that quotes from that district court decision. If I were the district court's law clerk, I would have, you know, said, let's change that citation. But we don't review district court decisions because of improper citations. We review what the district court did.
Unless the district court relied upon something that turned out to be incorrect, and it seems like that's what happened. In that case, we do worry about it.
I think the question is whether the district court abused its discretion in approving the settlement. And the Ninth Circuit's decision in Rose pointed to a whole set of very troubling signs of collusion that, you know, that indicated heightened scrutiny there, none of which are present here. You had more money going to the lawyers than the class. You had coupons. You had, you know, injunctive relief that was valued at $1 million. You had the difference between reversionary and non-reversionary funds. So on every single metric, this case is fundamentally different from that case. And yet, this district court in this, I think, honestly, a pretty unremarkable and, in fact, miraculous settlement given the odds against the plaintiffs, put the parties to their paces. As I said, I mean, this was not a district judge who left anything to deference to the parties.
So you would ascribe a near religious certainty to it.
Well, I think when you ask, did the district court abuse its discretion, you're asking, what did the district court do? Not, did the district court cite one case that was the wrong
case? Let me just interject here. So the district court said, and I'm quoting, the settlement agreement is therefore presumptively the product of an inclusive arms length negotiation.
Yes.
And then cites Roe v. SFPSC. So are we supposed to ignore that language and not say that it had a presumption?
Or no, are we supposed to? Judge Ikuda, I don't think I was clear enough earlier. So the she is saying is this is presumptively the product of arm's length negotiation. There's nothing wrong with that statement. What would be wrong would be if the court said, because there was arm's length, after all, Rule 23E directs the court to determine whether there was arm's length negotiation. What would have been wrong is if the district court drew from that conclusion a presumption that the entire settlement was fair and then applied that presumption rather than engage in the kind of rigorous analysis that we think the district court did.
Before that sentence, he says, in addition, the involvement of experienced class action counsel and the fact that the settlement agreement was reached in arm's length negotiation after relevant discovery had taken place, create a presumption that the agreement is fair, which is what you just said was wrong.
Well, I don't think there's anything in the district court's decision that shows that she relied on a presumption that the entire agreement was fair and declined to engage in careful scrutiny as a result. And just to, you know, make this clear, the next page, right, if you flip to page 5 of the opinion, this is excerpts of record page 8, what she says at the end of this paragraph is this factor weighs in favor of approval. Again, there's nothing wrong. It's sort of tautological. Obviously, if there's, you know, arm's length negotiation, then the factor about arm's length negotiation is, you know, weighs in favor of approval. But that nowhere else in the opinion is there an indication that the district court allowed that to prevent her from engaging in the kind of rigorous scrutiny that's required. And that was the problem in Rose. The district judge in Rose started with that presumption and ended with that presumption and did not look at the subtle signs of collusion that were that infected every aspect of the settlement in that case.
Okay, we've let you go a little longer here, Mr. Gupta, because we love listening to what you're having to say. So now we have Mr. Cowie. Mr. Cowie, I'd like to ask you, I didn't ask your colleague about this, but so far as I can tell, no circuit has addressed whether an objector can waive an objection related to the district court's legal standard. The Newberg Treatise suggests that he can. Would you like to comment on that, please?
Your Honor, Paul Cowie for Appellee Swift Transportation Company. May it please the court. I didn't catch your full question. Would you mind repeating
it? I'll be happy to repeat it. What I said was that no circuit that I'm aware of has addressed whether an objector can waive an objection related to the district court's legal standard. There's been a claim that it was waived. So what I want to know is, do you have any authority that you can cite that would say that in this case, Mr. Peck could, or Mr. Maris for that matter, has or does not have the right to waive an objection to the district court's legal standard applied in this case?
Your Honor, I'm not certain that I followed the exact question. In terms of some of the issues that are being raised on appeal, they are being raised for the first time by Plaintiff Mayers and Peck, and they were waived because they were not raised at the trial court.
My question is, is there a case law that says that an objector can't waive that because it goes to the heart of what happened here, the district court's standard for review? Can an objector waive that issue?
Your Honor, in a typical class setting, if an objector has not raised the issue in the trial court, the objector is then not able to raise that issue on appeal.
Well, wait a second. I don't really understand this. The appeal is claiming there are errors in the district court's opinion. Obviously, you can't raise an error in the district court opinion before the district court issues its opinion. How can that possibly be waived? I mean, that's what happens in every criminal case, in every civil case. If you're identifying an error in the opinion, you haven't waived it before the opinion is issued. So help me understand how that could possibly be waived.
Judge Ikuda, I think it depends on which issue we're speaking to, because we aren't being precise. If we're talking about the Rose issue that you were just speaking with my friend, Mr. Gupta, in terms of the overall appeal, it's very clear, in terms of the overall decision, it's very clear the district court went through each of the Hanlon factors and carefully scrutinized the settlement. This case is not on all fours at all with Rose, where there were numerous red flags as to collusion. Having personally litigated this case for over a decade, I can tell you that there is far from collusion, and very much to the contrary. It took us over a year after mediation to even reach a conclusion.
But it is true, is it not, that the settlement agreement had not been approved in this case before the district judge blessed the settlement, right? I mean, before the district judge approved this matter.
Your Honor, I didn't understand the question. The settlement agreement had not been...
What I'm saying is that your colleague referred to a presumption, and I thought that in Rose you had a similar situation where the settlement agreement had not yet been approved and the district court applied a presumption in favor of the settlement agreement, even though the agreement itself had not been signed. In other words, when it's before the district court makes the determination, then you have a certain standard of review afterwards. This was done before. That's just like Rose, is it not?
No, Your Honor. Here we had a signed settlement agreement, preliminary approval granted. Mayors and Peck had the opportunity to object.
You say preliminary approval was granted. Yeah, do you have a record site on that?
Yes, the preliminary approval order. Your Honor, I can get it, but it's in the record that the order was preliminary approved about 6 months before final approval.
But the class wasn't certified. Isn't that right? That's what makes it the same as Rose. The class was not certified. There had been no class certification. So it was unknown whether the district court had denied class certification and no class was certified, which was the same situation as in Rose, correct?
Well, you say that's the same situation as Rose. That one point, a class had not been certified because in this case, in Mara's case, and in multiple other cases, class certification had been denied on very similar facts.
But that's what we relied on. We said a settlement agreement when the class certification has not yet occurred requires heightened scrutiny. So the district court was bound to give heightened scrutiny under our decision in Rose, correct?
No, Your Honor, the principle that stands for is pre-class certification is because the parties are deemed to have not, how much discovery has been conducted, how much does the court know about the case?
And that's not what we just said pre-class certification, and both of these situations are pre-class certification. Could you just tell me, am I right on that? Isn't that correct?
That's what you said in Rose, but the principle for it was because the court didn't know, or the parties presumably didn't know as much about the case. But the
just for clarification, Judge Ikuda, of course, is correct. I misspoke when I said settlement agreement. It's the fact that there was no class certification in this case, and there is a heightened review required. And the question here is, did the district judge go forward with a presumption that everything was okay?
No, and that's the point, Your Honor, and that's the point my friend Mr. Gupta made, which is even if a heightened standard applied, this district court went through each of the Hanlon factors, went through, it's very clear from the final order, looked at every aspect of the agreement, requested additional briefing, requested additional evidence, allowed objectors to argue extensively both at the preliminary approval hearing and at the final approval hearing. There was multiple briefing from multiple parties in addition to the two appellants we have here, and it was very carefully scrutinized under even a heightened standard. And Your Honor, as I would bring you all back to, it's the appellant's burden here to make a strong showing of a clear abuse of a discretion. And we all have an extremely limited role in reviewing an approval of class settlement that the district court made. And so in terms of wordsmithing a long and detailed order and trying to nitpick as to whether there was one site which maybe now isn't perfect, it's very clear what the district court did was apply the Hanlon factors, and it met the heightened scrutiny, even if such heightened scrutiny applies.
I take your point, but on the idea of abuse of discretion, it is an abuse of discretion to apply the incorrect legal standard, is it not?
Your Honor, that would be correct. Our point is that the court went on to apply even the heightened scrutiny.
Yeah, I get that. Your point is that even if the court said the wrong thing, what it did complied with the Hanlon factors, and that's enough. Is that right?
Exactly. Otherwise, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me ask my colleagues, does either have any additional questions for either Mr. Gupta or Mr. Cowie?
No.
Okay, very well. So we're back to Mr. Fialco, who has a few minutes, and also Mr. Clapp has a few minutes. So we'll start with Mr. Fialco.
Thank you, Judge. I want to respond to Judge Smith's inquiry when I decided to reserve my time, and that was whether or not Mr. Peck has any standing whatsoever. Before I get to that, though, we've been talking about handling factors, Rule 23, but understand that under the California statute itself, there's an independent basis that a judge has an obligation to review the PAGA settlement to determine whether or not it's fair. What characterizes it being fair is an issue of discussion. But the law has been, everybody did a good job and put the law in the briefs. But I want to talk to you for a minute about the practical approach. If this court was to take the approach that there's no standing for a PAGA objector, on whatever legal basis they do, what is the effect of that to the California PAGA statute itself? Does that create more collusion? Does that create a scenario where you are creating a scenario where two parties, in when there's multi-people trying to do the claims for the LWDA, get left out of the park and claims are being sold at wholesale? Doesn't it kind of go against the whole idea of an adversarial system where there's notice and everybody gets a chance to talk about what's right?
State's claim? I thought it was the state's claim. Like in the False Claims Act, it's the state's claim. So, of course, if the state didn't think that it was being properly presented, the state could intervene pursuant to the statutory permissions.
Judge, I have to disagree with your perspective because from the way I see it is that the under the California statute, if the condition precedents are met, there is a proxy of the state's agency's rights that goes to the deputized individual to make those claims. Now, let's say under a different commissioner, 5 years later, they decide to get more active and take away those rights and get more involved. But right now, we have a policy by a commissioner that decides to leave it to the individuals that have the proxy. And so
isn't that the state's prerogative to do so?
It's the state's prerogative to do so, but it's also the court's obligation to realize that the state is leaving it to the proxy. So then if you say the proxy doesn't have the right to advance the objectives that they think is best for the state, then it's like being on a Mobius strip and there's no way off.
Okay. Let me ask my colleagues, does either have any additional questions for Mr. Fialco?
No.
Very well. So, Mr. Clapp, you're the last word here. You have 55 seconds.
Your Honor, thank you very much. I guess, you know, what I'd like to say is, if we look, you know, the court should have applied a heightened standard. I think we can all agree on that. And if you look what the court did, it failed to do that. And the clearest point to look at, I think, is just the math. Math is math. And you can see that they, you know, if you go through and just do sixth grade arithmetic, that their math just does not add up. We really don't know how many class members they are. They say there's 19,500 class members, and yet their own evidence suggests that in a shorter period of, an included period of time, there was 20,900 members. They say there's, 850,000 work weeks, yet their math doesn't add up. If there's like 2,000, average drivers in a work week and 669 work weeks, the math doesn't add up. If the math
you're out of time, but I have one quick question I asked my colleagues if they have additional one. I want to ask you, does Mr. Peck have standing with respect to PAGA?
Mr. Peck?
That's
Mr. Peck's question, so I'm not exactly sure, I think, but the answer I would say is absolutely yes. He went through the process, I believe, of going and asking the state of California whether he could be designated as its representative. And he was designated as its representative on these claims. So yes, in my view, he certainly does have standing.
Okay, let me ask my colleague, do either of you have additional questions for Mr. Clapp?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for your argument on this interesting case, the case of Peck versus Swift, and I've left out a lot of the other parties in this, is submitted, and the court stands adjourned for the week. Thank you all. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This court for this session stands adjourned.